I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. A Halloween tradition for some is to watch movies that scare the you-know-what out of you. And one of the best at doing that is Alien. Today we'll speak with the two minds behind a dissection of the 1979 classic horror film. They've dedicated a podcast to each individual minute of Alien. We'll find out what's behind the current trend of movies by the minute. Then Billy Collins joins us to discuss his new collection of poems, The Rain in Portugal. In it, the former U.S. poet laureate contemplates everything from a weather vane to Keith Richards holding up the world. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. There's a new trend in the film world, minute-by-minute dissections of great films. They've been done for Jaws, Goodfellas, Back to the Future, and Indiana Jones. A couple of Kansas City area screenwriters have also done the minute-by-minute treatment for Alien, the 1979 science fiction horror film directed by Ridley Scott. You're listening to the theme music to it right now. It's a film in which an alien stalks and kills the crew of a spaceship. If you're a fan of the film, or of the movie-making business in general, then maybe this might be the thing for you. With us this morning, Mitch Bryan's a screenwriter, filmmaker, and educator who teaches film at UMKC. He is also, and maybe most importantly, a longtime DVD guru on this program. Mitch, welcome back.
It's great to be here.
John Engel is a cartoonist, screenwriter, and lifelong cinephile. He's the author of the graphic novel Dodd Scowl, Investigations Volume 1, The Simian Case, as well as the comic strip Must Be Nice. John, nice to have you.
Welcome. Thanks for having me, Steve.
Well, Mitch, a minute-by-minute dissection of this thing, how come?
I got to toss that a little bit to John because it's his brainchild to do this, and he came to me and asked if I'd help out.
Why'd you want to do it, John?
Well, I listen to a lot of podcasts, particularly about cinema and geek culture a little bit.
Yeah.
And I was listening to a podcast called James Bonding, which it's a couple of comedians who talk about James Bond films one movie at a time. It's actually something that Mitch introduced me to. And one of them joked about talking about James Bond one minute at a time, and the other reacted by saying, well, there's actually a podcast out there called the Star Wars Minute that dissects Star Wars one minute at a time. First I'd heard of it, and it was eye-opening for me. I said, well, that sounds great. As many podcasts as I listen to, and I love Star Wars maybe more than anything else in pop culture. So I jumped right on it. I pretty much got addicted to it. And after they're all the way up into they've gone through the episode one, The Phantom Menace, already, and other minute-by-minute podcasts started popping up. Goodfellas, like you mentioned, Back to the Future. Mm-hmm. And as they popped up, I thought, I want to do one of these. So I reached out to them and said, hey, would you mind if I took Alien on? And they said, go for it. And I immediately contacted Mitch, who immediately said yes, kind of to my surprise. I thought there would have to be some persuasion.
I'm not that shocked.
But the funny thing, Mitch clearly did not know the time commitment he was making to make this podcast, because he jumped right on it, and then it turned out to be a lot of work.
I'm used to coming in here doing it live, you know, and this we edit, and we, you know, it's a more complicated process.
What do you learn by dissecting a film minute by minute? That sounds just so daunting to me.
Yeah, well, I've learned so much just about filmmaking, about how this particular film was made, and mm-hmm. we spend a lot of time looking at secondary sources and talking about the production of the film, so it's not just the dissection of the narrative.
Yeah.
So I've learned a lot about that, and a great movie can withstand 1 minute at a time. I'm completely still in love with Alien. I can't wait to see it Wednesday night. We're going to have a screening at the Screenland Armor, and I would like to watch the whole movie because I haven't watched the whole movie for, you know, I don't know, 8 months because mm-hmm. I've just been doing this 1 minute at a time thing. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure I'll see it in a completely different light.
Well, tell us a little bit more about Alien, John, because this is a classic film on any number of levels, right?
Yeah, it's pretty timeless, for one thing. Obviously, the the science fiction genre gives it a certain amount of timelessness. It's a rather ambiguous time period, you know, not being too specific about what future it is. Also, it plays off of recognizable motifs. So it's not the Logan's Run future that looks completely alien. It actually looks like these, the costume design is truckers in space and the spaceship looks like a freighter, things that we recognize. So I think that created a timelessness that was able to put it in that cult category. And it continues to be relevant now. But it's just such a rich film, and it's so perfect. Honestly, there are things about it that I nitpick. We were having a minute-by-minute podcast is a nitpicky thing by nature.
Yeah.
But in the end, watching it start to finish, to me, it's perfect. So I thought, Mitch and I had some nuanced conversations about it in the past. He was a professor of mine at UMKC, and we would sit over beers and talk about movies a lot. And I thought, man, this was the one I think that we could really get into. And
tell us the plot again, Mitch, because I remember seeing this film with my sister back in 1979, and this thing scared the living snot out of me.
It was
just awful.
Yeah. So a crew is awakened in mid-transit. They are a commercial towing vehicle, and they
a commercial what vehicle?
Towing vehicle. A refinery.
Right.
And they're awakened from suspended animation because there's been a signal that the robot ship has picked up, right? So they are, protocol says, wake everybody up, go down to the planet, investigate. They find a ship, they find eggs, and one of the eggs hatches and attaches itself to one of the crew members, and they bring it back on board the ship, and hilarity ensues after that. And it becomes, you know, the thing gets bigger and people start dying, and a character we don't know is the main character emerges as the main character, a female character, Sigourney Weaver.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a nail biter. I mean, it is really... And I think the fact that we're looking at it 1 minute at a time has proven to us that Ridley Scott, who came out of commercials, really saw the movie kind of in 30-second and 1 minute increments. So the movie moves really quickly, even though people think about Alien as being kind of slow and deliberately paced, which is true. But you look at it this way and you realize, man, that the thing's just clipping right along.
1 minute at a time, people will wonder, so how many podcasts are we talking about, John?
Well, the movie technically is 116 and a half minutes long. We ended up doing 115 episodes. We just finished recording them yesterday. So
it's completed now.
It is completed, and we are about 2 weeks away from completion as far as airing goes. I think that the stuff we recorded yesterday will be on next week, and then it will have ended its run.
And if people want to see this, they should go to alienminute.com, right?
Right. Right.
And you can already see the first.
They can subscribe and download the podcasts and enjoy the ride with us.
Who else stars in this film, John?
We have Sigourney Weaver, who, as Mitch mentioned,
this is her breakthrough role. Right?
Absolutely. She had done a small role in a soap opera. Then she was in Woody Allen's movie Annie Hall for some. I don't know how much he shot with her, but in the end, she only ended up in an extremely wide shot, which you would never know she was in if you weren't told. And then here she is. She becomes the star of this this massive blockbuster. I think that's one of the more interesting things that we talk about as well. There's also Tom Skerritt from MASH, Harry Dean Stanton from everything, especially David Lynch films, if you're a fan of those. Yaphet Kotto.
Veronica Cartwright. And Ian Holm, I think that's the cat. And John Hurt.
Yeah.
Seven people.
The director is a guy named Ridley Scott. Tell us about him, Mitch.
So he came up through commercials. He was one of that generation, along with Adrian Lyne and Alan Parker, who kind of made their bones in British TV commercials, who came over to the United States. He had made one film prior to Alien called The Duelists, which is a terrific picture. And then, of course, after Alien, he made science fiction history again by making Blade Runner and, of course, has enjoyed this extraordinary career. And winning the Oscar for Gladiator. And
what's he known for? I mean, what does he do with film that makes it a Ridley Scott film?
He's known for atmosphere. He creates these really extraordinary visual landscapes that the films take place in. He's always interested in the way the movie looks and in the world that he creates. And so he's a real world builder. And certainly with Alien, you completely believe this reality that has been set up.
John, this is a film that enjoyed both commercial and critical success. Tell us about both. How well did it do at the box office, just roughly speaking, and the critical success that it enjoyed as well?
I actually have to toss the box office to Mitch. We were just discussing this earlier.
I know. We were going to talk about it this week, and we forgot to look it up. I mean, it was definitely a huge hit. It was made for very little money, respectively. I mean, Star Wars had come out, and it was made for less money than Star Wars.
That was one of the reasons this film was made.
Same studio.
Was a sense that science fiction could that movies could capitalize on science fiction in the wake of Star Wars.
Exactly. But it was an R-rated movie. It was a very adult kind of movie. It wasn't as shocking as it is. It's totally believable because it really takes itself and its characters seriously. And so the critics were more or less supportive of it. There were a few quibbles. There were a few people who thought it was too exploitive. It was too shocking. I know that it's been such a part of popular culture now that it's hard not to know what the alien looks like and know about the famous scenes. But you remember, Steve, when it came out, nobody had seen anything like this before.
Yes.
I'm hoping there'll be at least one person Wednesday night at the screening who hasn't seen the movie. That would be really fun to have somebody see it that way.
And before we forget about the screening, it'll be where and when again?
So Wednesday night at the Screenland Armor, 7 p.m.
7 p.m.
Casey, your listeners can get in for $5 if they say the password Lambert, which is the character that Veronica Cartwright plays. Otherwise, tickets are $10. UMKC students get in free. But it's going to be great on that big screen at the Armor, and we're going to have some trivia and some prizes, and we're going to have a little post-film discussion. It'll be a great way to celebrate the movie and celebrate the end of the podcast.
Well, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date. We're talking about a minute-by-minute dissection of the film Alien that Mitch Bryan and John Engel have put together. Well, you guys brought a clip with you, and this one is a tense scene of the crew meeting after the captain's been killed, trying to trap the alien in an air shaft. Ripley emerges as the hero here. Anything else I need to say about this?
Not really, except that this is a one-minute clip, so this is what we would be looking at from start to finish, and we can talk about that when we finish listening to
it. Okay.
How come I don't hear anybody saying
nothing around
this
thinking.
Place?
Unless somebody has got a better idea, we'll proceed with Dallas's plan.
What? And end up like the others? No, you're out of your mind.
You got a better idea?
Yes. I say that we abandon the ship. We get the shuttle and just get the hell out of here. We take our chances and just hope that somebody
Lambert,
picks us up.
The shuttle won't take four.
Well, then why don't we draw straws?
I'm not going in these drawers. I'm for killing that goddamn thing right now.
Okay. Well, let's talk about killing it. We know it's using the air shafts. Will you listen to me, Parker? Shut up!
Let's hear it. Let's hear it.
It's using the air shafts.
We don't know
that's
that.
The only...
Well, the clip stops mid-sentence.
Yeah.
What do you do in a case like that?
We take it up to that point. And
you literally go minute by minute.
We'll finish the scene tomorrow, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so that makes it interesting. More often than not, though, we have been shocked to find that scenes do seem to kind of end on the 30-second and 1 minute. Again, that's part of, I think, that commercial background that Ridley Scott came from.
Yeah.
So we have a lot of clean endings for our minutes, too, but I just thought I'd, you know, share the dirty one.
So you guys say what about what we just heard? Where do you start with that, John?
Well, we mainly get into what this means. Mitch and I are both writers, so we tend to analyze it from a story perspective as far as what is the motivation of having this scene? How is it going to move the story forward? What are we saying about the characters in this scene? We get into that, and then we'll get into the minutiae of it a little bit. In this particular minute, there's actually an interesting thing. I kind of laughed when I realized what we were listening to. There's a moment earlier in the film where Yaphet Kotto's character, Parker, his friend has been killed, played by Harry Dean Stanton. And he says, in no uncertain language, the thing is walking around the air ducts. In this clip, Ripley says, it's walking around the air ducts. Parker replies, well, you don't know that, which is very strange. Now, we could look at that multiple different ways, and that's what we end up discussing. You can look at it as a line flub. You could look at it as, we know that Yaphet Kotto was told to improvise in the scene to wind up Sigourney Weaver,
mm-hmm.
how they got the performance out of her. Or you could look at it as Parker's a jerk and he's just winding up Ripley. You could look at it any different way. So that's one of the things, you know, that we specifically talked about on the episode that when we talked about that minute.
Well, I noticed that a lot of these podcasts run 25 or 30 minutes. So if you do the math on that, then the movie lasts 115 minutes. You're going to end up talking about it for multiple hours.
Right, 50 hours or whatever. Now, we have help, though. We have guests that join us on every show. So we've had critics. We've had special effects artists. Our good friend Ian McNeice, who's on the show Doc Martin, Skyped in from England because he'd worked with several of the actors from the show. Filmmakers. We had a computer interface designer talk about the procedures designed to blow the ship up at a certain point and how the computer would do that and what are the protocols for designer interface. We've had podcasters from other shows. We've had model makers. So we've really tried to approach the movie from all sorts of different angles and have different experts come in and talk about different aspects of the movie.
Well, you also have a clip from yet-to-be-released episode 108 that illustrates some of the characteristics of this podcast. Set it up for us. Who are the guests there?
So this is Jerry Porter and then Tom Taylor and Pete Mummert. They're from the Indiana Jones Minute. And one of the things that we've been able to do is we've been able to guest on other Minute podcasts, and those guys have come on our shows. And so we're talking about – this is later in the movie when we realize that the alien has stowed aboard the shuttle. I can't remember the actual Minute 108. And we've got one of the guests, Jerry Porter from the Indiana Jones Minute, who brings it.
Okay.
Well, now I had a question specifically about this. Does the alien speak English?
Well,
like because he's in the air ducts, right?
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden he hears, like, does he hear T-minus 10 minutes? And he's like, oh, I got to get the hell out of here to the escape shuttle.
This is actually a really good question. We've talked a little bit about this, that, you know, the geography of the ship as it's established here in the last 20 minutes or so, and then the alien's position between Ripley and the shuttle at that one point, and then he or she is not there anymore when she comes back, right? And the discussion became, well, where did it go? It had to have gone straight to the shuttle. So it actually beats her to the shuttle, obviously. So how did it know to do that? And it's... You're right. Like, it's maybe
well,
it understood what was being said.
And there's all those horns going off, and you got to figure it's getting hotter in there, and it, you know, it's got to figure maybe that's it's either luck or smarts. I don't know which one it is.
Sounds like you guys have a lot of fun.
It's pretty fun. Yeah.
What kind of response have you gotten from listeners?
We've got a lot of good response. We have a Facebook page, a listeners group, for instance. That's where we get most of our feedback, and we have a lot of loyal listeners that come back with their ideas, their takes, their disagreements with whatever we're talking about. We have a particular a British gentleman who's a model maker out in England who has these – we have no idea where he gets these photographs from, but he has all these behind-the-scenes photographs of the models being made on the set that he sends us almost daily. It's been great. It's been – part of what we wanted to do with the show was get listener involvement. So sometimes we don't worry too much if we don't have the answer for something. We'll throw it out to them. Because we enjoy getting the feedback and letting them play their part on the show as well.
Well, that's great. Again, the podcast is available at alienminute.com. Mitch and John will host a night of alien trivia, giveaways, and discussion 7 p.m. Wednesday evening. They'll also screen a new 4K version of the film on the big screen at the Screenland Armor up in North Kansas City. Tickets are $10, but KCUR listeners can get in for $5 if they use the password Lambert. UMKC students get in for free. Mitch Bryan, John Engel, screenwriters extraordinaire, thanks so much for coming in. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll visit with former poet laureate Billy Collins about his new collection, The Rain in Portugal. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. On Friday, the film critics reviewed the latest indie, foreign, and documentary films. You can hear their picks and pans at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, reporters break down their coverage of the Missouri and Kansas election just a week before the election. Also, Washington Post columnist E.J. Dionne joins us to talk politics at a national level. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, whenever Billy Collins has a new collection of poetry out, a whole bunch of people stop and take notice. The one-time poet laureate of the United States, Collins may be the best-known poet in the country. He's the author of 11 collections of poetry, his latest, The Rain in Portugal. Of this new collection, The Washington Post wrote this: these pieces provided both pleasure and a vivid example of how one's thoughts, when unrestrained, can lead to unexpected destinations. He's a professor at the City University of New York. It was an honor the first time he was with us 2 years ago, and it's just as big an honor to welcome him again back this time. And Billy Collins, welcome back to Up to Date. So good to have you.
Well, it's very nice to be back. Thank you.
Well, the last time you were with us was the morning after. You may not remember this. After our baseball team lost the World Series, I asked you for some words of wisdom, and you responded by delivering a rewritten last four lines of Casey at the Bat. The good news is there was some joy here in Mudville, at least last year, Billy.
Well, that's true.
Yeah.
And I'm glued to this World Series now.
I am too.
Even though I'm a Yankee fan, but I'm a you could never tell that by the way I'm glued to the television set these days.
Yeah. I was really struck by what the Post wrote about this new collection of yours. You know, this notion that the book is a vivid example of how one's thoughts, when unrestrained, can lead to unexpected destinations. If that makes sense to you, how do you go about this process of unrestraining your mind, if you will, so that you can go where you want to go to write these poems?
It makes perfect sense to me. I think it's a pretty insightful comment.
I do too.
And I think it's, and I just heard it from you for the first time, but I responded to it immediately. I think it's because the mind is the default position of the human mind is usually restrained.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it's restrained by what we need to focus on for our jobs or family. It's restrained by obsessing about where we're going, about worrying about the past or the future. There are lots of, you might say, manacles that restrain the mind from drifting. And I think part of being a poet, at least these days, is finding a way that's becomes familiar and comfortable of daydreaming. You know, I think that's what of thinking without a destination and kind of wool gathering, and I think that's where often a poem begins, with just a little something that occurs to me while waking up or taking a walk or whatever. But it becomes a habit of mind, I think, the unrestrained mind, and there is a great deal of freedom available if one can kind of unplug from the restraints of the day.
Are you a daydreamer?
Oh yeah, I mean I'm an only child still, and that's a perfect preparation for being a poet, because you're alone much of the time, and you create a deep fantasy world populated by imaginary friends and self-aggrandizing fantasies of all kinds, and I think it's really children who come out of that kind of alone time where they are able to imagine in an unrestrained way, that prepares you for creative work.
Would you read one of the poems that really touched me in this collection? Was one of the early ones in the volume, and it's titled Only Child. And it was just such a lovely poem. Would you read it to us?
Sure. I've been meaning to address this subject ever since I was a child. Only child. I never wished for a sibling, boy or girl. Center of the universe, I had the back of my parents' car all to myself. I could look out one window, then slide over to the other window without any quibbling over territorial rights. And whenever I played a game on the floor of my bedroom, it was always my turn. Not until my parents entered their 90s did I long for a sister, a nurse I named Mary, who worked in a hospital 5 minutes away from their house and who would drop everything, even a thermometer, whenever I called. Be there in a jiff and on my way were two of her favorite expressions and mine. And now that the parents are dead, I wish I could meet Mary for coffee every now and then at that Italian place with the blue awning, where we would sit and reminisce, even on rainy days. I would gaze into her green eyes and see my parents, my mother looking out of Mary's right eye, and my father staring out of her left, which would remind me of what an odd duck I was as a child, a little prince and a loner, who would break off from his gang of friends on a Saturday and find a hedge to hide behind. And I would tell Mary all about that, too, and never embarrass her by asking about her non-existence. And maybe we would have another espresso and a pastry, and I would always pay the bill and walk her home.
Well, that's just such a nice poem. So you wish you had a Mary in your life now?
Well, I did when my parents were alive, and I, you know, having conjured up this imaginary helper who had come to my aid of tending to a pair of parents in their 90s, I thought, well, why not sustain her imaginary life into today, and pay her back some way, you know, by buying her a pastry and walking her home, which isn't much actually.
But. Yeah. Well, Billy Collins joins us from the studios of WMFE in Orlando, Florida. Are you always, we were talking about the unrestrained mind, are you always got a notebook handy jotting down just a few thoughts so you don't let them escape from you, Billy?
Yeah, I mean, that's part of the, you know, they say often a question is when you sit down to write, well, I never actually just sit down and here's a blank piece of paper and I'm going to, as they say, commit an act of literature. I always come to the desk with something, and that something is usually comments and observations that are found, yeah, in a notebook I carry in my back pocket. Some days I'm caught out. I was in New York, walking around New York City once, and something came to me, flew into my head that seemed to have some literary potential, you might say, and I didn't have anything to write with or anything to write on. So I went into a bank and I grabbed one of the pens that was chained to the desk and took some deposit slips and started to write the poem on deposit slips. I remember I was putting on a very serious face, like I was making an enormous deposit, so the guard wouldn't throw me out for being literary.
So you write on the fly then. You aren't sitting down and saying it's 8 o'clock in the morning, it's now time for Billy Collins to commit words to a poem here.
No, I don't have those daily habits, I'm afraid. And no, I was waiting for you to come on your program. I was working on a little poem here in the studio in Florida. So as Seamus Heaney said, I'm just a poet part of the time. You know, I'm also just going to the dry cleaner or the post office or doing what everybody else does. But, you know, the poetry switch gets turned on and then things tend to change. I feel like I'm going into a different zone. And it's a zone of real pleasure.
A zone of when you're writing, you're talking about.
When I'm actually writing. And I think it's such fun, basically, that I think a lot of poets pretend to be miserable in their poetry because they're trying to disguise so much how self-entertaining the whole process is.
Well, it's not supposed to be fun. It's supposed to be work, isn't it, Billy? Writing is hard.
Not writing is hard. Not having something to write is hard, and a week or two, or in some cases, I was listening to a couple of poets last night in their later years say that they haven't written in 2 or 3 years. That would kind of kill me. But it's interesting to wonder how much one's identity is tied up in what one does. I mean, if you stop writing, is there a way in which you're not existing anymore? Or is there a way in which you find some other existence? But it's immensely entertaining and pleasurable to start a poem and to be inside it. You don't know where it's going. You don't know if it's going. It could end up in the wastebasket. But it could be leading you to some kind of ending that never existed before. And the only way to get to that ending is through the passageway of the poem. So you're creating a kind of passageway to an ending. And that procedure is riveting.
This notion that you don't have a regular time to write, does that sort of help help you with the creative process of just being in a space that's not so tied down to what most of us are tied down to every day?
Well, I just think it takes the pressure off. I mean, if you don't sit down and, you know, put a water pistol to your head and say, right.
Yes.
I mean, what's productive, more productive than it would be if I sat down and tried to write something, is taking a walk. So I usually walk almost every day, you know, for a half an hour, 45 minutes. And that's often very productive, just the gait of walking. Wordsworth, they say, walked something like 250,000 miles. That's what people did back then instead of Facebook. They walked. and he wrote a lot of his poems walking in that kind of iambic stride.
The former poet laureate of the United States, Billy Collins, is my guest. I'm wondering, Billy, to what extent that poetry has suffered some of the same fate as jazz music in America, this notion that so much of jazz, you know, is inaccessible, unreachable, sort of up in the ether somewhere, and people have so much trouble grasping it and wanting to listen to it. So much of poetry, it seems to me, has become a turnoff for people because they don't get it. They spend some time, they immerse themselves in something, and they walk away as confused as when they started the poem, and it's completely unsatisfying.
Well, the smorgasbord of you might say of poetry or jazz is so enormous. You just envision an immensely long table that you can cherry pick. I mean, you can. I've been a jazz fan since I first heard it when I was 14 years old.
I can tell by your work. Yeah,
I don't. I'm not fond of super experimental jazz. I mean, I love Roland. I played Ornette Coleman in college, and Roland Kirk, and a lot of people like that, but I just go back to Monk and Miles Davis and Coltrane and Sonny Rollins, and all that stuff is there. And if you find poetry puzzling, you're just reading the wrong kind of poetry for you. Mm. I mean, some people, that's their taste, puzzling poetry, but there is so much clear, entertaining poetry that's being written today that has its depths, but it also has its superficial delights. It's immediate delights, I should say.
Well, and maybe that's the harder thing to do, isn't it? To communicate clearly, but with some depth. Sometimes if you're hiding behind complexity, maybe you don't really have as much to say as you thought you did.
Bingo. That's a great point. I mean, yeah. Excellent. When I was a younger poet, I thought that poetry had to be impenetrably difficult.
Yes.
And
yes.
But you know, you knew the poet was miserable. That's one thing you knew, if nothing else. And I wrote, as a teenager, I often wrote really difficult poems. And that's easy to do. It's really easy to write hard to understand poems. And I gave off whiffs of being alone and sad. But I think that's right. I think the... it's more daring, in a way, more self-challenging to come out from behind the hedge of language and to be clear about what you're saying, because you're open for attack. You know, people now know what you're saying, and they can go after you. But we don't care about them. We care about the people who are enjoy that kind of clarity.
Speaking of jazz, there's a piece in here, and I'm forgetting which one it is now, but it's about Bill Evans and a recording he did where you can recall at one point in the piece, every time you listen to it, it's a live piece and some guy's in the background laughing. Instead of listening to Bill Evans, who was absolutely blowing the doors off when it came to a new way of performing with the piano back in those days, and you sort of marvel at the guy who's talking and not listening to Bill Evans. We'd kill to listen to Bill Evans today, wouldn't we?
Yeah, well, that's happened. It happens in some symphonic performances too.
Yes,
where you can hear coughing, and also a lot of live performances of jazz that are held at clubs, even like dinner clubs. You hear a lot of clattering of dishes and knives and forks and conversation in the background. And, you know, apparently, I mean, it's hard to appreciate history when you're actually in it.
Of course.
You know,
of course.
If you're listening to some 1960 Bill Evans at Birdland or the Vanguard, and you've taken your date out, I mean, you can't think this is a historical moment. Stop talking to me. So it's all forgivable. But at the same time, you can't get too angry at these people, in silence on their knees while history unfolds before their very eyes.
Yeah. Let's go to your poem, Weather Vane, on page 26 here. And I was wondering, I was so struck by this one, too, because you conclude it by commenting on the notion that you happened to be thinking about this weather vane while you were in a cafe in Istanbul, of all places. And I was wondering if this was just one of those moments where you were sort of, your mind was just sort of free associating and you grabbed it and you're in a cafe in Istanbul thinking about the weather vane back home.
Well, I basically wanted to end the poem. And I mean, as I got close to the end of the poem, I wanted to end it in a faraway place because it's such a this weather vane actually is on top of our house.
Mm-hmm.
But it is such a domestic poem. It makes one move in the third stanza when it says the characters on the weather vane are like the characters on the Grecian urn of John Keats.
Right.
And then it kind of makes another move geographically.
Well, read it to us, if you would.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, let's stop talking about it. Weather vane. It's not a rooster, a horse, or a simple arrow, nor the ship or whale you might see near a harbor, but a cat silhouetted in black metal, extending a forepaw downward in order to reach one of the four metal mice perched on the arms that indicate the compass points. A mouse for the east, a mouse for the west, a mouse for the north, a mouse for the south, facing in all directions as the vane turns in the wind and the cat reaches down to snatch a wee one in its hooks. Like nothing less than the lovers on Keats's urn or the petrified bodies at Pompeii, here is another frozen moment in Western culture, for the cat will never consume one of the mice, and no mouse will ever be disjointed by the black cat, no matter which way the wind is blowing, no matter how madly the cat swivels on the roof. While you and I are at home, safe from a coming storm, or far away in another country, as we are now, thinking about a weather vane in a cafe in Istanbul.
Why did you want to end it that way?
Well, I'm a great believer in poems kind of starting in one place and ending in another place. And this was, I guess, example of starting in a domestic place and ending in an odd place. I've been to Istanbul, actually. I've sat in cafes in Istanbul. But to tell you the truth, this was a kind of, as many poems are, it was kind of a composite. It's not a complete fabrication. But I wasn't thinking of a weather vane in Istanbul. I was thinking of a weather vane home.
Yeah.
You know, truth be known.
Truth be known. You had already achieved a certain level of fame before you were named Poet Laureate back in 2001. But what did that title do for Billy Collins' career?
Well, it was nothing less than putting a booster rocket on it and sending it into another stratosphere.
Hmm.
The Poet Laureateship in the United States is, we don't pay as much attention to it as they do in Britain. In Britain, if the laureate dies, because until recently it was a lifelong appointment, there's great speculation about who the next laureate will be. Uh-huh. Whereas here, the laureateship lasts only a couple of years, and there's not that much speculation. But one gets a lot of media attention. I mean, from newspapers and radio programs such as yours.
Yeah.
So it does help get your name a little more into italics or bold print.
It's such a big deal in Britain because there's just that tradition there that people have, it remains important to a lot of people.
Well, they started it, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, about 350 years ago, I think. And, you know, we kind of, taking the term Poet Laureate from the British is really part of our you know, what you might call our Anglophilia, you know, our love of English jams and Burberry raincoats and the royals and all that stuff. You know, it's it just adds a little more dignity to the title, because the title used to be Consultant in Poetry at to the Library of Congress, which is doesn't have much of a ring to it.
not at all. But someone changed it at some point.
Yeah, actually, there's, the little story was that a senator from Hawaii, his name was Spark Matsunaga.
Huh.
I might be, I think that's close. At least I got the Spark right. Spark Matsunaga. And for some reason, I know little about him. I suppose he wrote poetry, but he lobbied for years to get a change to Poet Laureate, and people ignored him. And finally, I think he tacked it onto some bill that was sliding through Congress and got the nomenclature changed. And that was, I think, in the early 80s. And prior to that, the laureateship in the United States started in 1936. So from 36 to, I think, 82, it was that big baggy Consultant in Poetry to the Library of Congress period.
Well, you describe your work, and this quote just always has stood out to me, as suburban, domestic, it's middle class, and it's sort of unashamedly that.
Yeah.
Why those words to describe what you do?
I wish I'd never said that.
You want that one back?
That's you can't put the ring back in that bell, as they say.
But you said it. Why?
Well, I think it was actually. I mean, my persona. I mean, I've lived most of my life in the suburbs of New York. I now live in a suburb in Florida. I don't pretend to be crazy or impoverished or living in a ghetto or having psychiatric problems. Not yet, anyway. I don't know. There's a stability in my poetry. My persona is quite sane. I mean, he has some goofy thoughts, but he seems to be kind of oriented and. I wanted to just kind of claim that I'm not pretending to be any wilder or surreal than I am in real life.
What's the state of poetry in this country, Billy? I mean, do you see it breathless with new life, or is it down on its luck, or where is it today?
Well, that's a question I've gotten a lot. I mean, since I was Poet Laureate. And the best answer I can give is to refer to Joseph Epstein's an essay by him published in the late 90s. He said, if I was to answer that question describing the state of contemporary poetry in America, he said, it's flourishing in a vacuum. And that makes perfect sense to me, because it's flourishing in that there are tons of poetry activities going on. There are MFA programs galore, open mics, lots of prizes, magazines, online and offline, just a circus with many, many tents. And yet very few people outside that community read poetry. Hmm. So it's flourishing in the vacuum of its own audience. Most of the audience for poetry is other poets.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, one guy
that's
who,
the problem.
Yeah, one guy who appreciates a good poem is Garrison Keillor, and you've been on his show any number of times. I'm wondering what his retirement from A Prairie Home Companions means to poetry and poets.
Well, quite frankly, the new host, Chris, has invited me back on the program. Ah. I think I'm going back within the month.
Huh.
And so he is keeping poetry alive, or more importantly, my poetry alive anyway. So I don't know if it's going to be a regular feature, but I was very pleased to be invited back on. I will certainly encourage him with some recommendations to have some other poets on the way Garrison Keillor did, providing a poet with an audience of, you know, 2 to 4 million people, which
is a
lot more than you can fit into a church basement.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Another poem you wrote is The Bard in Flight on page 29. Such an interesting idea to me. Do you remember how it came to you?
Well, I was on an airplane. I don't know why, but, you know, again, these are composite experiences. One thing kind of hooks up with another thing, and you're not sure why. But I was looking down, you know, out the window there, Which I love to do. It's better than Sky Mall, more interesting than that. And I remember the line from Shakespeare. He says, this blessed plot, this England, this realm, this, sorry, this blessed plot, this earth, this realm, this England, as if looking down from a height.
Mm.
And Chaucer does that at the end of Troilus and Cressida. He goes up and looks down from the ninth sphere, and it says, this little spot of earth. So many poets fantasized about being up there somehow and looking down and envisioning it. But now we just go to the airport, and there we are. So I just imagine Shakespeare flying along with me and looking down and his wonderment at the perspective.
Would you read this one to us, too?
Sure thing. The Bard in Flight. It occurred to me on a flight from London to Barcelona that Shakespeare could have written this blessed plot, this earth, this realm, this England, with more authority had he occupied the window seat next to me instead of this businessman from Frankfurt. Of course, after a couple of drinks and me loaning him an earbud, he might become too preoccupied with Miles Davis at the Black Hawk at 36,000 feet above some realm or other to write a word. I imagine he'd enjoy playing with my wristwatch, the one with the tartan band. And when he wasn't looking out the window, he would study the ice cubes in his rotating glass. And he'd take a keen interest in the various announcements from the flight deck and the ministrations of the bowing attendants, all of which would be sadly lost on me, having gotten used to rushing above the clouds, even though 99% of humanity has never been there. Yet I am still fond of the snub-nosed engines, the straining harmony of the twin jets, and even the sensation of turbulence jostled about high above some blessed plot, with the sound of crockery shifting in the galley, the frenzied eyes of the nervous passengers, and the bard reaching for my hand as we roared with trembling wings into the towering fortress of a thunderhead.
That's terrific. The Bard in Flight by Billy Collins, his new collection, The Rain in Portugal. And Billy, it is always just a thrill to have you here. What a pleasure, and I wish you all the best as always, and come back here anytime you want, okay?
Thank you so much, Steve. It's been a pleasure for me too.
That's Billy Collins, the former Poet Laureate of the United States. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR. Up to date, follow me at Steve Kraske.
Okay.
Tomorrow, our team of reporters breaks down their coverage of the state and local elections. Also, E.J. Dionne from The Washington Post will be here to talk politics at a national level. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, Ryan Hennessy, and Corinne Dorian. Our senior producer is Steven Steigman. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.